The Business, House Business and Labor Committee for February 4th, 2013, our very first BNL meeting for the year.
Yay.
How'd that feel? Good?
Then I'd like to also open the informational meeting. And but before we get started, I'd like to go through and have everybody introduce themselves. This is the beginning of our very, very long session. We'll be spending lots of time together. And so if you'd like to introduce yourselves, where you're from, any other bits of information, starting at the end with Representative Matthews.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, and welcome everybody into the viewing audience at home. I'm Greg Matthews, Representative of House District 50, which is Gresham. I am a current firefighter, former police officer, and Army veteran. Most people don't recognize my background, though, that my wife and I own a business, which is a daycare, Small World Learning Center in Gresham. Just voted again the Reader's Choice Award winner for the best daycare in Gresham. We're not the best because of my wife or my work, but my wife's phenomenal. But it's about our employees. It's about our the wonderful staff and, of course, the community and the group that, you know, the citizens that support us. So we appreciate that. But looking forward to being on here. It'll be my third term in this committee. And looking forward to you being the chair and your direction, Madam Chair. So looking forward to working with you and the entire committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Thompson.
Jim Thompson, House District 23, which is basically the West Willamette Valley from the Midville city limits down to the Lane County line, not including Corvallis and Philomath. This is my first round on this committee. And very important issues, so I'm very glad to be here.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. State Representative Paul Holvey from House District 8, which is South Eugene, Alvador, Elmira, Vanita, Walton, Notai, Lorraine, and Crow.
Are those in Oregon?
Okay.
That's it.
Mr. Kennemer.
Bill Kennemer. This will be my third session as well on business and labor, and I served 10 years in the previous century on the business committee in the Senate, so I like this committee and excited about it. Appreciate being vice chair with Brent and your service, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Brent.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Brent Barton. I represent District 40. It's Oregon City, Gladstone, Jennings Lodge, Johnson City. And this is my second tour of duty on this committee. I'm a lawyer by trade, and I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, we're just doing introductions.
Just in time. Sorry, I'm late. I'm Kim Thatcher. I live close. I live in Kaiser. Isn't that always the way it goes? Anyway, this is my second time on this committee, and I actually am a business owner and have interacted sometimes pleasantly, sometimes also pleasantly, with many state agencies, and I hope to make a contribution to this committee.
Okay, thank you very much.
Morning, Madam Chair, audience members. I'm Brad Witt. I'm the representative from House District 31, which is Columbia County, Washington County, north of Highway 26, and that portion of Multnomah County along Highway 30 and Sovies Island. I'm a 35-year union representative, also an advocate for both workforce and business development as critical components of economic development, and something that I think our state is wantonly in need of. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, everybody. I'm Tim Freeman. I represent portions of Douglas, Josephine, and Jackson County. Starting my third term here, first time on this committee, and I own a small business in Roseburg, Oregon, where I live and raising my children, and I've owned that business for a little over 20 years.
Good morning, I'm Shamia Fagan, representing East Portland, Gresham, Damascus, Happy Valley, and a little bit of unincorporated Clackamas County north of 212. By trade, I'm also an attorney, a business attorney with the Ader Wynn firm. I'm a school board member on the David Douglas School Board, and I'm also a mom of a 5-month-old baby boy.
And I'm Margaret Doherty, chair of the committee. I'm beginning my second and a half term, I guess, my second term here on business and labor. I was, in my former life, I was a high school teacher at Milwaukee High School. And then I worked for the Oregon Education Association when I retired. I got retrained and started my own business. I'm a floral, also on the side, I'm a floral designer and own a small business in Tigard. Okay, so with that, with the introduction of the committees, a couple of things that we talked about, and I would also like to introduce our committee administrator, Jan Nordland, who we all know that have worked on committees before. We cannot work without our committee staff, and then also our committee staff that's over there. Thank you very much for assisting us. A couple of things about the Business and Labor Committee. Being a former teacher, I'm very, very cognizant of time, and so I always like to start on time, and we'll gavel down. Probably I'm going to try to shoot for 8:30 as opposed to 8 o'clock, because I think that when we look at agendas, depending on what the agendas are, I think an hour and a half is a good amount of time to get a lot of our work done. But again, if we have people coming from out of state or out of town and have a ways to go, we do want to give them the courtesy of giving them enough time to make their presentations. So we'll try to do the agendas that way. Speaking of agendas, we're hoping to get the agendas out 2 weeks ahead of time. We've got quite a few bills that we already have scheduled and lined up for the next couple of weeks, and we'll get that information out. And so other than being on time, the other thing that I would hope that we would all do is be courteous, one to one another, and then also to the people that are speaking and testifying. With the lobby, it's very, you know, they're used to this, and they know what they're doing, but we have a lot of people that come in and testify for the very first time. It's a very scary thing for them, so if we can give them courtesy, I would appreciate that. And then any time that you guys have conflicts, you know, time conflicts and whatever, just let us know, and we can work around what your schedules are. But that's what the expectations are I have for this committee. Since we have not gaveled down as a legislature yet this morning, we cannot conduct any business. And so what I thought we would do first is to talk about some of the new committee rules, and Jan's going to go over the committee rules, and then have an overview by DCBS a little bit, and then we'll be able to close. But committee rules, we do have a few new ones this year, and you should all have received in email a copy of the rules. If you need a copy of the rules, please let us know. Also, if you could also let Jan and the committee administrators know how you would like information, whether you want it, you know, on paper in front of you during the day or whether you just want it on computer, please let them know and they'll accommodate your wishes. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Committee rules.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, committee members, everybody should have a paper copy of the rules before them, and again, the committee will be voting on these rules on Wednesday. I just want to make a few points. Remember that a quorum is necessary for any kind of final action, but the chair can call can hold a public testimony with less than the quorum present. I want to draw your attention to Rule 15 on the minority report. A small change was made to that. For a minority report, as usual, it takes two members who have voted no on the measure to file a minority report, and you have to give notice of that to the chair or to myself by 5 p.m. of the day that final action was taken. The change that was made is just small, but saying that the issue in which you're basing your minority report had to have come up in discussion on that measure in that hearing that day. Any questions about that, talk to me, please, afterwards. And, of course, Chief Clerk.
That's a quick question.
Yeah. Sure.
So what if there was several days of a committee hearing and the discussion came up in a previous day of the same hearing?
My understanding is that is fine. As long as the issue was raised in the hearing so that the committee member had an idea of what your issue in the minority report is, it was raised in the hearing.
But if it was if that was on a Monday and the issue came up on a Monday and the hearing was still going on Wednesday, then Wednesday could be the day that they would file it at 5 o'clock as opposed to Monday, because the hearing was not complete.
It's 5 o'clock of the day that the final action was taken.
Okay.
But I think, his question was, must it come up on Wednesday instead of on Monday? Is that correct?
Yeah.
I believe the rules say that it has to have been raised just in the discussion of the committee. Does not have to be on any particular day. Please, I'll clarify that with the chief clerk. And on any of these rules, we always go to the chief clerk, Ramona Line, for any clarification when something is not clear.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll get back to you. Okay, any other questions? Next.
I want to point out Rule 17 is a new rule. The entire rule is new, and this deals with the committee member who has a potential or an actual conflict of interest. Prior to voting on the issue, the member can issue, can state that there is a potential or actual conflict of interest. And by 5 o'clock the following day, a written statement has to be submitted to the chair or to the committee, and that becomes part of the official public record. So that is a new rule for committees.
One more.
Any, Mr. Freeman?
Thank you, and I read that rule. There's no discussion about an enforcement measure. What occurs if somebody doesn't get their written statement in?
The rule does not discuss enforcement.
Thank you.
Do you want me to think of something?
And Madam Chair, just point out that the...
And actually, we'll find that information out for you and get it back to you.
Thank you.
And just point out that the rules are, they often point back to the House chamber rules. Mm-hmm. So they are like a subset of your chamber rules.
It's kind of blank, too.
And as I say, we'll get back to you with these questions, and we will vote on the rules first thing Wednesday morning. Okay. One of the things, since one of the departments that we work with quite a bit in the state of Oregon is the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So we invited this morning Pat Allen, who's the director of DCBS, just to go through and review what DCBS does and what they can do for us.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the state's primary business and business regulatory and consumer protection agency. Our mission is to protect workers and consumers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. The lights are going down. It feels like we're fading out here. What I want to do over the next few minutes is give you an overview of what the agency does, a little bit of how we do it. I'll highlight some of the approaches that we take in trying to deal with some of these issues, and talk about how we as a regulator try to function. I'm going to spend the next hour talking about our org chart. Not really, but we will.
Is this the last time we're hearing from him?
Just real quickly, I'm going to come back and talk about the what our individual divisions do briefly. But I want to show you basically. First of all, that we're organized into five functional areas that encompass statutory charges that you have given us to execute our mission. Workers' Compensation Board is actually associated with us for administrative purposes, but is actually an independent agency. It's an adjudicatory body that makes decisions on workers' compensation and OSHA on OSHA matters. An org chart inherently, though, is kind of an inward-focused. It's how we've organized ourselves. It's not really very useful for the public, or I imagine for you, for thinking about the work that we do. So I want to draw out a couple of things using the org chart as a tool to talk about the real work that we do. I've highlighted a couple of pieces of the org chart that talk about financial safety and soundness. So an inherent mission that we have for certain parts of the Oregon economy is to look at banks, credit unions, insurance companies, and assure that they are operated in a way that is financially sound. This is a line of regulatory theory that in the United States goes back to the 1860s up through the Depression, of recognizing that there's a government role to play to make sure that when we depend on some kind of a business organization for something that has to do with our money, whether it's our deposits in a bank or credit union or an entity like an insurance company that has to be able to come forward and pay a claim, that there's a role to assure that that entity is financially safe and sound, that they're able to make good on those claims. And we do that both in the insurance division and in finance and corporate securities, where we conduct financial examinations, audits, do those kinds of things that examine the underlying assets and business practices of the entities that we are responsible for regulating. We're also a consumer protection agency, and this lands as well in insurance and finance and corporate securities, but also in building codes division. This is the general notion that there are certain behaviors that either you should engage in or you should not engage in. Frankly, in consumer protection, we find more should nots than shoulds in most cases. But it's the idea of having market power and having a regulator who's able to provide oversight and make sure that you don't abuse that market power. And so we see that come up in areas like insurance, where we have a role to review insurance forms and documents and terms and conditions conditions to make sure that they comply with state law. Shows itself most predominantly in licensing, which we do a fair amount of in the agency, where you'll give us authority to license a particular activity and then set standards in one fashion or another for how the licensees in that industry behave. Our philosophy in most consumer protection areas is education of consumers, education of licensees, identification of issues when they occur, but then particularly fixing problems. We're not really about let's go catch bad guys and levy fines and that's a mark of getting something done. We're really about trying to identify problems that are occurring and getting those problems fixed. And so, for instance, in building codes, you'll see that when we have a consumer who's had work done by an unlicensed electrician, for example, a big piece of what we'll do is make sure that whoever engaged in that activity, among other things, arranges for a licensed electrician to go back in and take care of that work to make sure that the homeowner or consumer, underlying problem is taken care of. Worker safety, the worker safety system is a big piece of what we do, and I'll come back to that. We look at it as a holistic integrated system that goes from the OSHA side of making sure that workers are safe, kept safe and healthy on the workplace, to the workers' compensation side where we administer a system that assures that when something did happen to a worker, when they were injured, made sick, somehow impacted by their work, that there's a system that provides them health care that they need to be returned to the ability to work when they can, and income support when they can. Workers' Compensation Board, as I said, is an independent agency that we're responsible for some administrative duties for, but they're the body that makes adjudicatory decisions on disputes in this area. And then the last thing to touch on is building safety. This is the idea that we have a system in Oregon that assures minimum standards of construction safety. In Oregon, we have what's called a mini-maxi system. There is a single state building code. There's only a small handful of states that really approach it this way, where the building code in Prineville is the same as the building code in Portland, is the same as the building code in Port Orford. The idea there is really twofold. It's the notion that a homeowner or a child attending school or someone going into a public accommodation in any of those places is entitled to the same kind of protections for fire safety, electrical safety, those kinds of issues, and recognizing that from a construction standpoint, it's a lot easier to build easily across the state if you're not having to figure out what's the standard in Milwaukee and how's that different from the standard in Oak Grove and how's that different from the standard in Oregon City, as an example. And so we have a uniform system. I'll come back to that issue in just a minute. Just very quickly, this is a notion of what that looks like from an operating budget standpoint. Our operating budget is about $200 million. We have a staff of just over 900 employees. About half that budget is the worker safety system, OSHA, Workers' Compensation Division, Workers' Compensation Board. That system is paid for by what's called the Workers' Compensation Premium Assessment. That's basically a tax on workers' compensation premiums, currently set at 2.1%. On the remainder of the activity in insurance, finance, corporate securities, building codes division, those are paid for by a variety of fees and assessments. I mentioned licensing as a significant function we do. When you give us regulatory authority, you don't give us broad authority that says go protect consumers or something like that. You give us fairly narrow authority that says go make sure plumbers are licensed, and you authorize us to create a license and to charge a fee for that license and pay then for a program that does that regulation. And so we actually have a very large number of those kinds of statutorily directed kinds of fees and assessments, and that's how we pay for the bulk of the remainder of our regulatory program. So let me now loop back around and talk just briefly a bit about, in some more detail, about the functions that our divisions deal with. Finance and corporate security, you'll remember that they were the first one I talked about under the notion of financial safety and soundness. And when you think of this division, you primarily think of regulating banks and credit unions. That's a big piece of what they do. And that really is aimed at financial safety and soundness within those industries. But they also are charged with probably the most diverse array of other very narrow and specific kinds of regulatory authority. So, for example, DFCUS, as we call it, is responsible for regulating pawnbrokers in the state of Oregon. They're responsible for regulating funeral trusts. This is the notion of going into a funeral home and prepaying for funeral services. There's a trust account that's established to pay for that. We assess those funeral operators on the basis of the assets in their trust account to assure that if something happens and that particular funeral home's trust account isn't the way it should be, that there are funds available to cover those needs. We also then regulate activities in that narrow piece of the funeral industry. There's actually a funeral and mortuary board that deals with the rest of it. This is the area that we deal with mortgage lending, some amounts of mortgage loan servicing. This area is characterized by a split of regulatory authority between the federal government and the state government. It's called dual regulation in banking and credit unions, and it can cause a fair amount of confusion for consumers, particularly, that we try to work through. And it's the idea that a twofold concept that is encompassed by dual regulatory authority. One is that every bank and credit union out there has two regulators. In almost all cases, that's at least the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that makes good on deposits if a bank goes under. But then it's also some kind of a substantive regulator. For national banks and nationally chartered credit unions, that's the Office of Comptroller of the Currency for banks, National Credit Union Administration for credit unions, or it's a state charter. So those entities will have either a state or federal charter, and if they have a state charter, will be that safety and soundness regulator. There are 18 state chartered credit unions, currently 28 state chartered banks. Obviously, we've come through a really difficult time for those entities in Oregon. I think we lost six banks over the course of the recession in Oregon, and we're now in the midst of a period of consolidation in that industry. We haven't had a bank actually fail in Oregon since 2009, but what we're seeing now are banks that are merging, being bought out, and having impacts locally in the economy as that occurs. Let me give you a highlight of sort of one of those behavior kinds of issues that we focus on in DFCUS. Right now, obviously, with as many people as are suffering from challenges with their mortgage, there's a real growth industry. You'll see them on late night TV of call this number and we'll do all kinds of magical things with your mortgage to make it go away with no harm to your credit, and all you have to do is give us a check for $600 up front or all those sorts of things. That area is actually fairly tightly regulated. There are requirements to be licensed. There are a lot of rules about the kinds of things you can and can't do. And we work very hard to assure that people who are already in often dire financial circumstances aren't further taken advantage of by businesses in this space. Let me turn and quickly talk about insurance. Now, in banks and credit unions, I talked about there being split regulatory authority between state and federal government. In insurance, the exact opposite is true. This is entirely regulated at the state level. There are about 1,400 insurance companies authorized to do business in Oregon. Almost all of those are located elsewhere. And so when we talk about state regulation, we do that in partnership through an organization called the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It's a nonprofit organization made up of states, the primary state insurance regulators. And what they do is establish a nationwide uniform system that most states, including Oregon, try to adhere to in terms of standards and then regulate in partnership. And what that means is a state that has an insurance company, what's called domicile or based in that state, will take lead responsibility for regulating that insurance company. But two standards that we've all agreed to are the standards for behavior. Now, that varies a little bit depending on the topic, and there are circumstances where there will be Oregon-specific standards that really are different from NAIC standards, but in the main, that's how we try to regulate that area. This is also a good place to stop and talk for just a second about our regulatory approach, not just in insurance, but elsewhere, and it's the notion of competition as a tool for protecting consumers. We believe very strongly that vigorous, competitive markets with lots of players competing for business, whether it's deposit dollars or insurance premiums or services, is a very, very powerful tool to protect consumers, both in terms of pricing as well as in terms of of marketplace behavior. In insurance, particularly about 2 months ago, the American Medical Association did a research report and found Oregon to have the most competitive health insurance market in the country. And I think that benefits consumers. Among other things, Oregon has a very good rate of what's called it's medical loss ratio. It's in a fancy term for how much of your health insurance dollar goes to pay for health care, as opposed to marketing and overhead and all those kinds of things. And Oregon ranks very, very highly. And I think the competition in our marketplace is a big reason for that. So when you look at our mission, talking about protecting consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate, that supporting a positive business climate for us is not just a, by the way, while we do these regulatory things, think about that. It really is, how do we make sure Oregon is an attractive place for there to be lots of competitors in these various markets competing for consumers' dollars, because we think that's good for consumers as well. Let me touch on sort of the one obvious driving issue in health for insurance, and its implementation of health care reform. This is meant to capture simply the notion that we are one of three state entities largely responsible for implementing health care reform, the others being the health authority, which is the policy driver and deals particularly with provision of Medicaid and other services, Cover Oregon, which is the health insurance exchange. Our role is to regulate the market behavior of health insurance companies, and then we have a rate review role. Although I want to be clear about that role, we have a regulatory responsibility to approve rate increases for individual health insurance policies and for small group health insurance policies. Small groups are currently defined as groups with 50 or fewer members. The federal act will change that in 2014 to 100 or fewer members. But the bottom line of all of that is it's only about 10 or 15% of policyholders in Oregon whose policies pay rates that we have regulatory oversight authority for. We've spent a lot of work in the last couple of years trying to improve that system. Those rate review hearings are now done as public hearings, not simply as actuary-to-actuary discussions as they were previously. We've invested in webcasting facilities in our building so that those hearings are available for citizens to be able to tie into and see. I can't say it's the most exciting TV you'll ever find, but they're broadly available, and we think that's important. Let me talk briefly about Oregon OSHA. This is the state's worker safety and health agency. This is an area, thinking about different kinds of regulatory models, this is yet another model where the primary regulatory authority is federal, and they delegate operation of that system to the state as long as the state's laws and administrative procedures and program are deemed to be at least as effective as federal law. And that's an ongoing dance that occurs not just at the point that our program is certified by the Department of Labor, which it is, but in periodic visits by U.S. OSHA. We're very proud of the fact that we have a strong regulatory presence out there, but I think sometimes it's easy to get to think that it's more than it is. We have 79 inspectors who cover over 1.5 million workers. That means that if you just divided the number of work sites into the number of inspectors, we'd get around to you once every 26 years, which is pretty good compared to once every 131 years at the federal level. That's not the way we do it, though, obviously. We have a targeting system where what we try to do is we try to focus our scarce enforcement resources on those kinds of employers and work sites that provide the highest risk to employees. And so, for instance, construction sites are much more likely to be inspected than a retail store, because the risk to workers is higher in that area. We have changed in the last couple of years the targeting system that we use. We used to look at an individual business's experience as a driver of what would cause us to inspect, and that kind of led to the notion of someone got hurt for the first time in 15 years, and lo and behold, you'd have an OSHA inspection shortly after that. And we began to realize that really wasn't having someone hurt at a site in and of itself was not actually a great predictor of the inherent safety and risks at that job site. And so we've made a change to that system. We think we're doing a better job of doing that targeting. We also have a significant consultation piece of the system. It's the idea of being able to bring in someone from OSHA, not in a regulatory inspection kind of an environment, to work with the business to identify risks and help them come up with strategies to address those risks. There's effectively a firewall between that function and the enforcement function. If a consultant sees something that is an obvious, imminent threat to life and safety on the spot, they'll work with that business to correct it on the spot. But it's not in the context of fines and assessments and violations and those sorts of things. Let me then talk quickly about workers' compensation insurance. Again, this is a system paid for by an assessment of workers' compensation premiums. This is an area where this committee will probably see a fair amount of traffic in terms of statutory changes. You'll have, I think, largely primary jurisdiction over those kinds of issues. This system, there are some players in this system. Let me just skip ahead quickly. If you were to go back in time 20 or 25 years, you'd find that Oregon had probably one of the very worst workers' compensation systems in the country. We provided poor benefits to workers who were injured. We had a system that was expensive for employers, time-consuming. Nobody was happy with the system. Governor Goldschmidt at that time called together representatives of employers and labor to the then brand newly designated Governor's Mansion, Mahonia Hall, to work out a set of changes to that system, now colloquially called the Mahonia Hall agreements. And for the last 25 years, we've, to one degree or another, been implementing those recommendations to huge success. We now have workers' compensation premiums that are amongst the least expensive in the country. We have an excellent system of benefits. And that's a fairly carefully calibrated system. One of the biggest roles in that system is what's referred here as the Management Labor Advisory Committee, or MLAC, as we call it. This is a group evenly divided between representatives of business management as well as labor and employee groups. And they really are the policy caretakers of the system. It gets us a couple of benefits. Any significant changes to the workers' compensation system in one fashion or another go through MLAC, and that gets us a couple of things. It means that when you see a change that has come through the MLAC process, you know that proposal has been pretty thoroughly vetted with extensive research, with documentation, with discussion. You also understand that it then represents some kind of a consensus between management and labor that proposed change is an appropriate thing to do. We think that's enabled us to have an extraordinary winning streak in terms of improvements to the workers' comp system and make sure that system is stable without whipsaws of policy back and forth as times change. In Oregon, we saw 2 decades of decreases in workers' compensation premium rates. That streak was broken 2 years ago and with a small rate increase, and again this past year with a small rate increase. What we're really seeing is, if you were to graph the changes as a result of Mahonia Hall, that graph would start very steep in the first years and shallow out as we've gotten to the last few years. We're really at about the end of the improvements in costs that we can wring out of that system based on that set of changes, and now other drivers of workers' compensation costs are beginning to be more significant. Healthcare costs being the primary one, you're now seeing that show up as a significant driver of costs in the system. And then last, let me touch on the Building Codes Division. A couple of roles here, and again, this is yet another model of how to deliver regulatory services. I mentioned the mini-maxi single state construction standard. There's actually not such a thing as a building code. There are a set of building codes, plumbing code, electrical code, boiler code, mechanical code, and so on. Each of those areas has a board whose members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, with which we share some sort of authority, and it varies a little bit across those boards, both in setting the substantive standards as well as setting licensing requirements and standards for the professions skilled construction trades that are related to those areas. The actual performance against the code, on the other hand, is largely delivered through local local government. We have state authority to issue building permits and do inspections, and in 100, over 130 cases, we have delegated that authority to a county or a city or some combination of county and city. Typically, a county will have responsibility, for instance, for the electrical program in the whole county, where each individual city will have its own plumbing and structural program, as an example. And so we work in partnership with those building officials in those local jurisdictions to do the while they do the actual work of implementing what that statewide code is. That puts us in a position to have some dispute resolution abilities if there's a disagreement between a local building official and a contractor on what the code actually says in a particular case. And it allows us to work with them to identify local solutions to particular local kinds of issues. In this area, you are likely to hear about county payments cropping up as we talk about the delivery of the building safety system. There are a handful of counties in Oregon that are in trouble in a variety of areas, and their building program is certainly not even top on the list. But this puts us in a position of needing to sometimes deal with taking a program back. If we take a program back from a county, that means that the local building department in Curry County, for example, would be delivered by us here in Salem, 250 miles away, and what could possibly go wrong with that? So we're working very hard with those jurisdictions to try to figure out ways that we can avoid that from happening. We think having those services delivered at the local level is the best. There is a governor's bill that deals with that issue, as well as I think some stakeholder bills trying to talk about how to flexibly deliver those services at the local level so that we can try to avoid having that happen. The last thing I'll touch on in building codes, there are some areas where we actually do inspection building permits statewide for specialized things like elevators, boilers, manufactured structures that get shipped around the state, and we retain statewide authority for that. Here, the issue to touch on quickly. I talked about that system of 130 cities and counties that issue building permits. That's actually a really complicated system, and I touched on I think some Clackamas County areas as an example. It's really actually fairly hard if you're the builder to figure out who do I go to for my plumbing permit versus my electrical permit and those kinds of things. We've created a first of its kind in the nation statewide system that we're adding jurisdictions to every month to create an online system where you're able to submit plans, purchase permits, schedule inspections, find out the status of building permits to create a one-stop shop. We think it's actually a pretty neat system that is very successful and is becoming a model in other parts of the country now for how to deliver these kinds of services. With that, I know I have flown very fast and low over a bunch of stuff, but I'd be happy to answer questions you might have.
Any questions, Mr. Allen? Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Allen, you had indicated in your testimony that your department believes in a competitive market, and you specifically cited the insurance industry.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us the market concentration ratios for workers' compensation insurers in the state of Oregon, the top two and top three insurers?
Not off the top of my head, but I can certainly report that back. The simple version, of course, is that the public corporation SAFE represents something like half of the marketplace with a variety of other providers. I'll get you a detailed breakdown of that. I would quickly characterize it to say that we have a marketplace that's a little bit unusual in that we do actually have multiple players who participate in that insurance market. Many states have just a single state-owned provider or a state-owned provider that is much more dominant, but we'll get you some detailed numbers on that.
Madam Chair, would it be over 75%
For SAFE?
For the three top insurers?
I wouldn't want to hazard a guess.
Madam Chair?
Any more questions?
You also indicated that there were two decades of, I believe it was, pure premium decreases in the state of Oregon for workers' compensation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how much money that the two decades of decrease represents?
Again, not off the top of my head, but I can get you that dollar amount. It's significant.
Madam Chair? And I would also be interested in knowing how much workers' benefits increased during the same two decades.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you. We get that information back to Representative Witt. Mr. Holby.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, I was curious, you had talked a little bit about the Building Codes Division and, you know, referring to some of our counties that are having trouble providing service. I know there's cities that are also now having trouble providing what I would consider adequate or timely services in the realm of building permits and building inspections. And I'm a little concerned about how that plays out in the marketplace and the slowdown that seems to be happening in that area. Does the state have any sort of agreements, or does the Building Codes Division have the capacity to branch out and help sort of pick up the slack in these local governments that seem to be having a lot of trouble of providing those services?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey. In simple terms, do we have inspectors standing by who can suddenly go out and do work that we weren't doing before to take over for a city or county? No, we don't. And that's part of what we are trying to deal with in budget and other legislation to try to add some flexibility to try to do that if we need to. In the main, what we try to do, however, is work with multiple local jurisdictions to try to find creative local ways to solve those kinds of problems. A number of years ago, for example, in North Central Oregon, rather than individual cities and counties having a building program, the program was assigned to the local council of governments, and so they're able to blend their resources across several counties and cities in the Mid-Columbia area to try to deliver those services. We work with a city and county often trying to find creative ways to use an intergovernmental agreement to provide backup services or divide work or those kinds of things to try to get through this. We've been doing that for really about the last 5 or 6 years as we've gone through this period of really slow activity in construction, where it's often been hard for a small city, for instance, to keep a viable building program. We've done everything we can to try to keep that, though, at the local level again, because we think that's best managed there as opposed to being run from Salem, when we can avoid that.
Okay. This follow-up. So are there any requirements or guidelines for local governments on their standards for providing those services, in terms of how long does it take to get a permit, how long does it take for plan review, you know, those sorts of things?
Yeah, Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, we do not have regulatory standards that have some kind of a day limit or those sorts of things. What each city and county is required to do is to submit to us its service delivery plan for a period, and we're able to work with them to identify ways that they can improve their service. Contractors and developers, if they're having a concern, can identify those kinds of concerns to us, and we can try to work those out. There are national standards for the Building Officials Organization, International Code Council. There are voluntary standards that cities and counties can work to adhere to, but we don't have a hard and fast regulatory standard for those kinds of functions.
Thanks.
Okay, other questions? Okay, Mr. Allen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I close the informational meeting. Any other non-business things you want to have before we adjourn for today? Okay, that's it. I close the meeting of the House Committee on Business and Labor. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Hello, Chair.